Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Cold War Exiles and the CIA Plotting to Free Russia by Benjamin Tromley, narrated by Sean Renette. Note on transliteration and Russian names. I use the abbreviated American Library Association Library of Congress system for translation from Russian into English. This holds when rendering Russian names into English, even in cases where the individuals transliterated them differently. Thus, I refer to Boris Ivanovich Nikolaevsky, despite the fact that he published widely in English as Boris Nikolaevsky. I offer first names and patronymics, Boris Ivanovich, when referring to an individual for the first time, when available. Thereafter, I provide a shortened form, B.I., in the case of Nikolaevsky. Many Russian emigres who exited the USSR during World War II changed their names after arriving in the West, a practice connected to their attempts to escape repatriation to the USSR. To indicate such shifts, I mention both surnames when first referring to an individual, with the individual's original name coming first. In subsequent references to an individual, I employ only the surname more widely used at the time. For simplicity's sake, I use only the first names and patronymics that individuals adopted after emigration. Introduction. In 1949, Harper and Brothers published 13 Who Fled, a book purporting to be about typical Russian men and women all recently escaped who tell their personal stories. The authors told of tragic lives that had inspired them to flee their homeland, recalling starving peasants, despotic commissars in the Red Army, loved ones who disappeared during the Great Terror of the 1930s, and the ubiquitous threat of denunciation. The book's editor, the American writer and former communist fellow traveler Louis Fisher, drew the logical conclusion from the testimonies. Soviet society was mired in poverty, fear, and corruption, and the moment the door opens, Russians escape to the West. With its political geography of the Free West and a totalitarian East, 13 Who Fled was emblematic of American Cold War culture. But the volume's rousing narrative papered over more complex historical realities. The book's various authors had escaped during World War II, which meant that the land they crossed over to was Nazi-occupied Europe, not the democratic West of the Cold War. The notion of escape to freedom that the book advertised was also questionable. Some of the authors had been slave laborers, brought by force to the Third Reich, or Soviet prisoners of war captured on the battlefield. The book did not mention another inconvenient fact. At least one, and probably more, of the memoirists had collaborated with the Germans during the war. Clearly, the volume obfuscated the wartime pasts of the 13, imposing on them a misleading narrative of Cold War boundary crossing. Like the tales of its authors, the volume itself had a backstory that Americans could never have guessed. 13 Who Fled was a product of unlikely cross-cultural contacts during the early Cold War. Louis Fisher's son George had grown up in Moscow in the 1930s before moving to the United States, his father's home country. He learned of the Russians eking out a living in war-torn Germany from Russian exiles he knew in New York. Soon, Louis's wife, the Russian-born Bertha Markusha Fischer, encountered the uprooted Russians while working in Germany as a European representative of the International Rescue Committee, IRC. Markusha, a former supporter of communism turned American patriot like her husband, marveled at the displaced Russians' desire of bloody revenge against Stalin, and periodically attached anti-communist manifestos penned by her new Russian friends to the letters she sent home to the United States. Here, she explained to Louis, was a Soviet Russia we had never known, a generation of Russians who had come of age under Stalin yet were eager to fight his tyrannical regime. Soon, more powerful Americans replicated the Fischer's discovery and patronage of the Russian anti-communists in Germany. In the late 1940s, the Truman administration, amidst fears of communist expansionism and subversion, launched a program of covert operations against the USSR and its newly formed bloc of satellite states in Europe. As part of this effort to go on the offensive in the Cold War, the new Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, offered covert assistance to underground resistance movements, guerrillas, and refugee liberation groups representing the peoples under communist rule. The Russian communities championed by the Fishers appeared to be ideal recruits for such combat on the clandestine front. Indeed, the Russian co-editor of 13 Who Fled, Boris Alexandrovich Troitsky-Yakovlev, became the head of the Institute for the Study of the History and Culture of the USSR in Munich, funded by the Central Intelligence Agency. Other Russians, many of whose biographies resembled those of the 13, would carry out U.S.-funded covert operations aimed at destabilizing the USSR, which included producing anti-communist propaganda in Russian, sending agents on secret missions into the USSR, and seeking to convince Soviet soldiers and administrators in East Germany to defect to the West. This book tells the story of Russian exiles' roles in the Cold War in Europe. What were the agendas of Russian anti-communists, and how did the U.S. government seek to promote them as part of the Cold War? What forms did their collaboration take, and how did the Soviet state seek to thwart these subversive activities? These lines of inquiry bring into focus a distinct political sphere that took shape within the wider Cold War in Europe. The Russian émigrés were the symbols and potential architects of an anti-Soviet Russia, and therefore they became the object of the designs of policymakers and intelligence officials from different countries. As conveyed by the publication history of 13 Who Fled, anti-communist Russians in Europe became actors in a Cold War enterprise that involved secret intelligence operations, deceptive propaganda, and the forging of unexpected alliances. An anti-communist troika, Russian exiles, Americans, and Germans. A central theme of this book is the interaction of ideas and identities among different actors involved in Cold War plots to free Russia. The approach adopted here is transnational, meaning one that focuses on connections, borrowings, exchanges, and influences across borders and national categories. Political emigrations are inherently transnational in nature, as they serve as nodes of physical, intellectual, and cultural exchange among their country of origin, their land of exile, and sometimes third countries embroiled in their affairs, such as the United States, in the case discussed here. The American Emigre Project to Liberate Russia created an institutional and political framework in which different national brands of anti-communism interacted, producing ambitious political agendas as well as chronic strains and misunderstandings. What follows is an introduction to the three main political contexts from which U.S. plans to subvert Soviet rule in Russia emerged: American anti-communism, the Russian diaspora, and Cold War conflict in divided Germany. American support for anti-communist Russian exiles was, to an extent, a logical development of the Cold War. As early as the Russian Civil War, the Wilson administration had not only participated in the Allied military intervention in Soviet Russia, but also launched the kind of covert political measures against the Bolshevik regime that would become common during the Cold War. Little wonder that soon after the anti-Hitler alliance in World War II collapsed in the 1940s and East-West tensions set in, Washington turned to the task of subverting the Soviet regime from abroad. At root, U.S. support of the Bolsheviks' exiled opponents was an example of the proverbial befriending of one's enemy's enemy. The Russian exiles' participation in America's Cold War, however, was more meaningful and also more complicated than the framework of a pragmatic marshaling of assets against the USSR would suggest. To gain a fuller picture, one can turn to an episode recounted in the memoir of a CIA officer from the period, William Sloan Coffin, a civil rights activist in the 1960s. Coffin recalled a conversation with the CIA chief of station in Frankfurt in 1950, during which the Russian-speaking Coffin was tasked with seeking out Russians in Germany for use in the agency's nascent program of covert action. Coffin and Dave, as the higher official was called, were simultaneously drawn to the Russian people and repulsed by the tyranny of their rulers, and agreed that supporting Russian rebels against communism would be a noble endeavor. Soon the conversation between the two Americans switched into Russian, and Dave's face relaxed. He warmed up several degrees. He began to gesticulate energetically. The CIA official, it turned out, had studied Russian history and literature at Berkeley, and for him, Russians were something of an obsession. Dave's concern for the well-being of the Russian people, let alone his excitement about Russian culture, were hardly a preoccupation for most Americans fighting the Cold War in Europe. But his obsession was not an isolated case. A driving force of American involvement with the anti-communist Russians, examined in this book, was liberationism, an intellectual and political position that advocated U.S. support for the freeing of Russians from communist rule. The purveyors of this view, sometimes dubbed liberationists, included not just some CIA officers, but also Russian experts in the diplomatic service, journalism, and academia. Far from a monolithic group, they had divided views on the Russian people and their history. Some liberationists viewed Russians as a democratically minded and European people, while others thought they were neither. Yet they were united by the conviction that behind the Soviet facade there existed another Russia, which awaited an opportune moment to assert itself, weapons in hand if necessary, in the name of national freedom, and that supporting it should be a major goal of U.S. foreign policy. In an important study, David Fogelsong has argued that liberationism had deeper roots than Cold War confrontation. Instead, dreams of rousing the Russian people against communism were part of a century-long American drive to penetrate, open, and remake Russia. In Fogelsong's formulation, Americans had long viewed Russia as an imaginary twin, a country that was somehow similar to the United States, but badly in need of American missionary zeal, liberal institutions, and capitalist development. Fogelsong's account has done a great service by revealing the American cultural, religious, and also racial assumptions on which belief in Russian liberation rested. However, seeing liberationism as a projection of American identities fails to capture the transnational character of the phenomenon. The liberationists' embrace of Russia was hardly imaginable without their relationships, intellectual, political, and often social, with Russian émigrés. Russians who had fled communism, or were driven from it, appeared to Americans as prima facie evidence that Russia was both capable and worthy of liberation. The liberationists' embrace of émigrés reflected the prominence of the latter in Russian studies in the United States. As was presumably the case with Dave at Berkeley, Russian liberationists received from their Russian instructors not just knowledge of a language and culture, but also exposure to the distinctly émigré conviction that the true Russia was that of pre-communist vintage. At first glance, the influence of liberationism on U.S. foreign policy during the early Cold War would seem to be an unlikely development. As the liberationists themselves stressed, their view of Russia ran against the grain of much American public opinion at the height of the Cold War, when hatred for the Russians and a demonization of them as people prone to Asiatic despotism were common. However, the liberationists had the advantage of belonging to a small pool of Americans who had expertise about the new Cold War opponent, or at least the USSR's Russian core. Moreover, they had one of their own at the nerve center of U.S. foreign policy during the onset of the Cold War. As a head of the policy planning staff at the Department of State from 1947 to 1950, George F. Kennan was not just the author of the policy of containing the Soviet Union, but also a crucial figure in institutionalizing the apparatus for pursuing organized political warfare as a component of U.S. foreign policy. His influence was crucial for launching the different secret projects involving Russian exiles. Liberationism, along with its indisputable corollary of reliance on émigrés, shaped U.S. covert action projects against the Soviet Union. There were practical reasons for the U.S. intelligence establishment to cultivate Russian exiles, who promised to provide the Americans with otherwise unavailable resources with which to fight the Cold War. Intelligence on the secretive and closed Soviet bloc, and footholds in their homeland that might prove crucial if a hot war were to break out in Europe, as many feared was imminent. But the liberationists pursued an altogether bolder strategy of utilizing Russian exiles to foment disaffection in the USSR. As politically minded members of a fundamentally anti-Soviet nation, it was hoped, exiled Russians were uniquely poised to challenge the legitimacy of the Soviet state from abroad. A 1950 policy recommendation from the OPC, Office of Policy Coordination, a covert operations agency which was housed in the CIA, explained that the greatest menace to Soviet communism was Russian nationalism. Covert support of Russian exiles was a way to leverage the Russian masses in the USSR, a most valuable ally of the United States, against the Soviet state. A direct outgrowth of this strategy was the American Committee for the Liberation of the Peoples of Russia, Inc., a CIA-funded front organization made up of liberationist intellectuals that worked to mobilize exiles as agents of national revolution from abroad. In this and other projects, U.S. geopolitical agendas merged seamlessly into a transnational anti-communist mission to regenerate the Russian nation. As this book will show, the task of reconciling U.S. foreign policy and exile nationalism proved an exceedingly complicated matter. The Russian exiles were a problematic set of covert proxies for U.S. authorities, most of all because of a set of seemingly incontrovertible political and even geographical facts. Ethnic Russians were the state-carrying people of a Soviet state that was then extending its power in Europe, and the Russians showed no signs of rebelling against Soviet rule, or at least none that could be detected from across the Iron Curtain. On the contrary, the Russians had actually rallied behind Stalin during World War II to defeat the Axis invaders. The apparent stability of Soviet rule put a dent in the national legitimacy of Russian exiles in the West. Indeed, the Russians were at a disadvantage vis-à-vis corresponding emigre populations from Eastern Europe, satellite states, and the non-Russian areas of the USSR. While the latter could make the claim that their more or less recently annexed or Sovietized nations dreamed of independence, the displaced Russians were compelled to make the more difficult argument that the Russian people, 30 years into the communist period, remained unreconciled to rule from the Kremlin. Such stubborn realities cast doubt on the exiles' claim that the Russian nation was fundamentally opposed to Soviet communism, leaving them no recourse but to rail against Western commentators who saw the Cold War enemy as being the Russians. A no less important problem for the exiles was the actual state of political life in the Russian diaspora. Russians abroad had no leaders with recent pasts of political relevance, let alone a government in exile that could unify the diverse collection of Russians stranded outside Soviet borders. Unfortunately, the Russian emigre leader with the greatest cachet abroad and at least some trappings of historical legitimacy, Alexander Fyodorovich Kerensky, the premier of Russia in 1917, who was toppled by the Bolsheviks, had a poor reputation among many Russian emigres. Unlike some East European exile leaders who had recently been ejected from government by communists, Kerensky's authority was based on a political career from the distant past, to say nothing of the fact that he was commonly blamed for failing to prevent the Bolsheviks' seizure of power. The émigrés' lack of authoritative leaders was symptomatic of the deep internal dissension within the Russian diaspora. To be sure, internal divisions have been common to all political emigrations, a product of the powerlessness and frustration of exile, as well as the constant struggle to maintain their national cultures abroad. Following this pattern, infighting plagued U.S. plans to organize East European exiles in the late 1940s, particularly the Poles. Nevertheless, the Russian political scene was distinctive in its extreme internal acrimoniousness, which was mostly a result of the diversity of the Russian communities on which it was based. The Russian diaspora, or emigration, emigratsiya, was composed of successive population outflows resulting from Russia's 20th-century political catastrophes. The staggered flow of emigration from Russia created a pattern of distinct exile generations, or waves, as they are usually called. The so-called first wave of Russian émigrés exited the country during the Russian Civil War, while the second wave, that of the 13, consisted of Soviet citizens displaced during World War II, typically as prisoners of war, slave laborers, or collaborators of various kinds. During the early Cold War, exiles from these two waves frequently clashed, a pattern that reflected their distinctive memories of the country they had left behind, as well as their post-emigration experiences. Making matters worse, the political forces of the two waves were not themselves cohesive entities, but rather conglomerations of clashing organizations and interests. As a result of its intricate composition, the Russian diaspora's expressions of national identity tended to fracture into plural and conflicting visions. Deepening the troubles of Russian anti-communists was the problem of empire. Alongside the Russians, exiles from the various minority peoples of the USSR were also active in exile and competed for U.S. government support. The sharply contrasting national identities of Russian and non-Russian exile groups complicated CIA projects against the Soviet Union. While Russian exiles with virtual unanimity envisioned post-Soviet Russia as a multi-ethnic entity with borders similar to those of the Soviet Union, political exiles representing the non-Russian minorities of the USSR just as vehemently pursued independence for their respective nations. As a result, U.S. intelligence operatives and CIA-affiliated intellectuals faced a balancing act in working with Russian and non-Russian exile groups, which had mutually exclusive and generally inflexible national claims. American liberationists and Russian exiles, then, struggled to find common ground due to problems of national legitimacy, Russian émigré divisions, and the national diversity of Soviet exile groups. Factoring in the third major set of players in this book, Germans on both sides of the Iron Curtain, adds to this picture of troubled cross-cultural interaction. Divided Germany served as the essential setting for early CIA operations against the Soviet bloc, for a host of reasons. Its location at the center of Cold War Europe, the geographical anomaly of joint Allied sovereignty over Berlin, the presence of large populations of anti-communist displaced persons, including the Russians, in the country's west, and the stationing of Soviet troops in the east. In the vocabulary of Russian anti-communists, West Germany and Austria, at least until the withdrawal of occupation forces from that country in 1955, constituted the front of the struggle, places of political opportunity, intrigue, and also danger. Rather than just providing their battleground, German contexts and problems shaped the Russian exile movements. As already suggested, many exiles active in the CIA's projects had collaborated with Nazi Germany in some capacity, whether by choice or, as was especially common for Soviet soldiers detained in horrific conditions in prisoner of war camps, in pursuit of mere survival. Not surprisingly, Cold War Russian exiles derived from these and other wartime experiences a wide range of attitudes toward the German population. Russian émigrés were embittered at the brutal treatment Germans had meted out to their countrymen during the war, and they resented the hostile attitude of many post-war West Germans toward the presence of extensive displaced populations in their midst. Moreover, Russians who had collaborated during the war had a strong incentive to distance themselves from the defeated and discredited Germans. At the same time, some former collaborators hoped that their past ties to the wartime Hitler state might prove useful in the current struggle, with the new West Germany serving as an anti-communist patron distinct from the powerful yet unfamiliar Americans. To some extent, such ambitions bore fruit. West Germany was not only an anti-communist state, but, at least on the level of rhetoric, a revanchist one, as the government of Konrad Adenauer espoused the goals of reuniting Germans in the Soviet occupation zone to West Germany and returning Germans expelled from Eastern Europe after the war to their homelands. Moreover, the West German state employed many former servitors of the Third Reich, whose hostility to the USSR matched that of the Russian exiles. Indeed, an early player in Russian émigré politics was the Gielen organization, a spy organization consisting of the holdovers from Hitler's intelligence organization on the Eastern Front, Fremde Heere Ost, Foreign Armies East, which was revived by the U.S. Army and then passed to the CIA. What follows will explore the contacts between exile and West German anti-communists and the tensions to which they gave rise, particularly with regard to divided war memories and national identities, as well as to CIA operations carried out on West German territory. The Cold War project to liberate Russia, then, was based on transnational flows of power, ideas, and memories, all of which were sometimes constructive, but usually frictional in nature. The primary actors were the Russian exiles, who were divided into groupings with disparate and often mutually exclusive ideologies, notions of history, and political affiliations. The Russians competed with other exile communities from the USSR, whose political programs and geopolitical visions were often diametrically opposed to theirs. Surrounding the exiles of all stripes were powerful outside political actors in the Cold War West, including American and West German policymakers, administrators, and intelligence officers, who were all hostile to communism, but pursued their own interests toward the exiles. The result was a kaleidoscopic anti-communist sphere in which not just the intentions and actions of different actors, but even the Russian nation that the exiles purported to represent, took on shifting shapes. The Secret War, Spy Services and the Emigres. A crucial framework for the Russian anti-communist enterprise remains to be explored: the activities of clashing intelligence services in Cold War Europe. In order to undertake anti-communist activities on a serious scale, Russian exiles had no choice but to operate in the murky world of espionage agencies. The Truman and Eisenhower governments were loath to admit that they were backing Russian and other East European exile organizations that attempted to violate the sovereignty of Soviet bloc states during a time of peace, a course of action that might pose risks for U.S. diplomacy and national security. For this reason, the task of cultivating the exiles fell to U.S. intelligence agencies, or sometimes to ostensibly private bodies that were hidden fronts for them. In Spy Argot, the emigres operated primarily into the sphere of covert action, or activities undertaken to influence conditions abroad that could not be traced to, or at least might be plausibly denied by, the U.S. government. For the United States, the adoption of covert action as a regular tool of state was a Cold War phenomenon. Quickly emerging as a super-agency for intelligence and covert action after its creation in 1947, the CIA was the first peacetime entity of its kind for the United States. For the emergent U.S. security establishment, the expansive new paradigm for understanding covert action was psychological warfare or political warfare, terms often used interchangeably to signify the use of all political instruments short of war against an enemy, in this case, world communism. Although the U.S. government waged political warfare across the globe, the crucial target was the Soviet bloc, against which the CIA undertook what has rightfully been called a secret war. That included propaganda operations, both those including black disinformation and unattributed but ostensibly truthful or gray information, subversion, sabotage, espionage, and at least in the case of operations toward Albania, even the training of paramilitary forces. Bold U.S. psychological warfare plans against the Soviet bloc bore very meager results. As Stephen Long has recently argued convincingly, the U.S. political warfare campaign against the Soviet bloc was marred by strategic confusion. Bureaucratic infighting bogged down political warfare agendas as the State Department, the CIA, and the Department of Defense clashed over the shape of covert action and control over it. In the process, essential questions about political warfare went unanswered. Was the objective to topple communist governments or to spur them to reform? How were aggressive attempts to weaken communist states via covert action to connect to the policy of containment, which isolated the Soviet bloc, and therefore might work to strengthen the USSR's control over its European empire? And how could the U.S. government utilize its new covert action capacities without provoking the Soviet Union into a military response? None of these questions found conclusive answers, with the result that grand plans for political warfare gave way to a haphazard collection of operations that did little to weaken Soviet rule. Paradoxically, a political warfare program that produced futile...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?